this edition for Saturday, February 27th.
The bill is passed. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
President Biden's American Rescue Plan passes the House. A third coronavirus vaccine is expected to roll out in days.
Hi.
And in our signature segment, Amsterdam's museums innovate as COVID closures continue. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. Early this morning, the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives passed President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package.
The bill is passed. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
The bill, known as the American Rescue Plan, passed 219 to 212 on a near party line vote. Two Democrats voted no, along with all Republicans. The bill is the third stimulus package approved by the House since the start of the pandemic. It includes $1,400 stimulus payments to individuals who make less than $75,000 a year, or couples making less than $150,000. It extends federal unemployment benefits through August and increases weekly payments from $300 to $400. The bill allocates close to $70 billion for coronavirus testing, contact tracing, and vaccine distribution, and would authorize almost $170 billion for schools and universities and an additional $350 billion in state and local government aid. The legislation also increases the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, but that may be cut when the bill goes to the Senate next week. In very brief remarks this morning, President Biden urged a quick vote.
And the people of this country have suffered far too much for too long. We need to relieve that suffering. The American Rescue Plan does just that. It relieves the suffering. And it's time to act. I thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
A third COVID-19 vaccine is being readied for rollout in the U.S. this weekend. Yesterday, a panel of experts unanimously recommended approval for use of Johnson & Johnson's one-dose vaccine. In a statement, the Food and Drug Administration said it will move quickly to grant an emergency authorization, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is expected to issue final approval tomorrow. Johnson & Johnson said it expects to ship the first doses early next week and will be able to deliver 20 million doses by the end of March. With a new vaccine on the horizon, expectations are high that President Biden's goal of getting 100 million vaccines into arms in his first 100 days is closer to being met. But as Kaiser Health News correspondent Rachna Pradhan explains, the new doses are a step toward that goal, but not a panacea.
So, Rachna, this week we've heard a lot about Johnson & Johnson and the promise that it holds. It's a single shot. There's supposed to be millions of doses. And people are kind of expecting a quick fix here. Well, put this in perspective for us.
Well, Johnson & Johnson's vaccine will definitely add to the U.S.'s arsenal, if you will, of available shots for people. But I think that it's also important to acknowledge that we are far from being able to vaccinate everyone who wants to be vaccinated. Initially, Johnson & Johnson says upon receiving the necessary authorizations from federal officials, they'll be ready to ship immediately about 4 million doses. And by the end of March, they say they'll be able to provide 20 million doses. So that's 20 million people who could get vaccinated by the end of March with Johnson & Johnson. But as with our earlier vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna, these things don't come, you know, at the flip of a light switch. It takes time, a lot of effort, and a lot of very tight regulations and scientific precision to vaccinate as many people as we need to and to produce the doses we need.
Give us a breakdown, for example, of the supply chain that's required to get the vaccines made.
Historically, with vaccine production, you need raw materials, you need capacity in your manufacturing plants. And we know that there are certain bottlenecks that are likely to happen or that the pharmaceutical companies need to overcome. And one of the big ones is a challenge historically has been kind of toward the tail end of the process when you get to finishing your doses, putting them in vials and packaging it. That we know has been an issue for Pfizer and Moderna both. And with Johnson & Johnson, they've also, Biden administration officials have said that Johnson & Johnson was behind on their manufacturing, in part because of needing to source raw materials, but also equipment.
The administration set out some ambitious goals early on and saying what they hope to accomplish, how many people they hope to have vaccines accessible to. Are we likely to hit those goals? Put the number of vaccines into perspective here.
I do think that the goals that the Biden administration have announced are doable. But that being said, especially when we look at Pfizer and Moderna, they have openly acknowledged and they will have to significantly ramp up their manufacturing capacity compared to what they have been doing historically. Pfizer, for example, has about 6 weeks to provide 80 million doses. They provided 40 million doses in roughly 2 months to the US government. Moderna is similar compared to what they were manufacturing in January. We know that they made about 19 million doses, and that's not enough if that doesn't increase for them to meet their promised 100 million doses by the end of March.
What about just availability? I mean, I don't know if it's anecdotal, but we hear from lots of different parts of the country that it's not nearly as accessible as it should be. It's not getting deployed as fast as it can.
We are far from the point where it will be easy for everyone to get a vaccine. And I think one of the unique challenges that I want to highlight here, states now increasingly are moving toward opening up vaccinations to broader segments of the US population, but the supply is not there. And so I do think it's going to be a challenge for the next couple of months. And then hopefully toward late spring and summer, we'll start to see some greater progress.
Rachna Pradhan from Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
For the latest national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. The FBI has reportedly identified a suspect in the death of U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who was injured during the January 6th attack on Congress and later died. Citing two unnamed law enforcement officials who were briefed on the investigation, the New York Times reported yesterday that new video points to an individual attacking several officers with bear spray, including Sicknick. According to the Times, FBI agents suspect that the 42-year-old officer's death was related to inhalation of a chemical irritant such as mace or bear spray. Officials cited in the report say video evidence shows the unnamed suspect discussing attacking the officers with bear spray before the attack. Medical examiners have not ruled on the cause or manner of Sicknick's death, pending the results of toxicology tests. In Colorado yesterday, a man was sentenced to nearly 20 years in prison for plotting to bomb a historic synagogue in 2019. 28-year-old Richard Holzer was arrested in 2019 in an undercover FBI sting after agents saw his social media posts promoting white supremacist violence. Holzer pleaded guilty to attempting to destroy the Temple Emmanuel Synagogue in Pueblo, Colorado, with an explosive to stop people from exercising their religion. Judge Raymond P. Moore described Holzer's life as filled with violent and hateful imagery and described the case as dripping with Nazism and supremacy. The Anti-Defamation League Mountain States region says the bomb plot against Colorado's second oldest synagogue was one of 61 anti-Semitic harassment and vandalism cases it tracked in 2019. In Myanmar, protests continued today in several cities against the military coup that ousted the civilian-led government. In central Myanmar, police fired tear gas at protesters, forcing many to flee. In Yangon, police cracked down on demonstrators who gathered to chant and sing, calling for the country's detained civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi to be released. One protester said she came out to show support for Myanmar's ambassador to the United Nations, who made an impassioned plea for help from the international community yesterday. According to Myanmar State TV, the ambassador was fired today. Security forces arrested demonstrators across the country as the coup continues to bring hundreds of thousands of protesters into the streets. In Great Britain, a World War II-era plane flew overhead and soldiers honored 100-year-old Captain Tom Moore during funeral services today. Moore raised more than $40 million for the country's health workers during the COVID-19 pandemic by walking laps in his garden. He became known worldwide as Captain Tom and inspired the nation with his charity project. Moore died February 2nd after being hospitalized and testing positive for the virus. A patchwork of COVID-19-related regulations applies to museums around the world. In New York and Rome, museums are open, but they're closed in Paris, London, and Amsterdam. This week, the Netherlands Prime Minister announced the country's lockdown will be extended until March 15th, keeping museums there closed and forcing them to find new ways to survive without visitors. Special correspondent Megan Thompson reports.
Corona times in Amsterdam. The city's miles of canals are still beautiful, but quiet. Popular squares like the normally bustling Rembrandtplein, deserted. And the city's museums, more than 140 in all, closed because of COVID, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. In 2019, there were 2.1 million visitors, 85% coming from abroad to see masterworks like sunflowers. Today, that gallery is empty, as are all the other galleries filled with priceless pieces by Van Gogh.
We're here in the middle of the day, and to see it so quiet, it's a real shock. It's kind of an introduction, and it's all about his self-portraits, as you can see.
Emily Gordon Kerr had been the Van Gogh Museum's new general director for just 6 weeks when COVID hit.
Normally, we would have generated about 4.1 million a month in ticket sales, and that went to nothing. So we really had to move fast. So we canceled building projects, we looked at our exhibition program, we looked at ongoing temporary contracts that we had with personnel, and really cut it down to an absolute minimum.
Three separate government-mandated lockdowns forced museums in the Netherlands to close for a total of 110 days last year, and for all of this year so far. Dutch museums were allowed to open briefly last June with strict social distancing rules in place. It's one thing for a museum like the Van Gogh to enforce safe distances in its large galleries. It's a trickier problem for another one of Amsterdam's most famous museums, the Anne Frank House.
The house and the hiding place was right up here.
NewsHour toured the museum with executive director Ronald Leopold. This is where 13-year-old Anne, her family, and four others, all Jewish, hid from the Nazis during World War II. The house is a maze of narrow staircases and small rooms.
So this is Anne's room. This is where she was in hiding.
The room where Anne slept is less than 7 feet wide.
There was a small table right there where she sat and wrote in a diary. As you can see, it's a small room.
That means even when they do reopen, as long as social distancing is in place, only about 25% of the people who normally visit will be allowed in. Many major Dutch museums are hanging on with a combination of cash reserves, endowments, and donations. The Dutch government has also stepped in with millions in subsidies to help cover lost revenue and salaries.
Same here.
Still, there have been layoffs.
I'm very happy about the way the government is supporting us in these times. It's just not enough. So we had to lay off about 20% of our staff. We don't know when social distancing will end. We don't know if and how international travel will pick up. COVID to us is a financial disaster.
In a survey among the 450 or so members of the Dutch Museum Association, 30% of the participants said they might not last another year. Three have already closed permanently, including two small museums on Amsterdam's historic Herengracht Canal.
The building is from 1675. So this is a twin building, and we had this building. Yeah.
For 5 years, the Dutch Costume Museum was a labor of love for Yolanda Vandenberg. She poured thousands of dollars into renovating and decorating the 17th century canal house and was looking at 2020 being a banner year. Then COVID hit.
This was the room of Volendam. We had every region with traditional costumes. We gave every region their own room. This was Zeeland.
As the owner of a private museum with a volunteer staff, she did not qualify for government assistance.
It's very empty now.
In July, on the verge of bankruptcy, she realized she couldn't make it.
It's the first time I cried about it. But it's good. It's over because nobody stops COVID, so...
Part of coping with COVID has meant Dutch museums thinking of new ways to stay relevant by offering mostly free virtual tours.
Even though museums in the Netherlands are closed right now, you can visit a lot of them online.
One of them is the Rijksmuseum, the National Museum of the Netherlands.
I'm here in a big, grand hallway full of Dutch art. All around me, I have a 360-degree view here of this hall. And many of the paintings have an option to click on them and learn more.
In the 17th century, Rembrandt van Rijn created a masterpiece packed with secrets. The Night Watch.
You can actually get a pretty good sense of the museum, a sense of the space, and also learn a huge amount about the contents in it.
Another museum in Eindhoven, a city south of Amsterdam, is taking virtual tours one step farther.
This is a telepresence robot, and with this robot you can log in from anywhere in the world with your mobile device or with your laptop and steer the robot around in the museum.
I was curious to take the tour myself. First step, logging on from my home office in Minnesota with special software.
Hi!
Good morning.
The guide, Marlene Harches, can see me and I can see her.
Thank you so much for having me. This is amazing. I'm like basically right there with you.
I use controls on my computer to navigate my way around.
The building is very big, so we go do a quick run through.
Okay.
Yes. So look at this painting. What do you see?
What do I see? I think I see a woman.
What makes you say it's a woman?
Maybe the hair, maybe the face?
Yeah. This is a famous work by Pablo Picasso. The work is called Femme en Verre.
When did Picasso paint this?
This is an artwork from 1909. So, we're going to go that way.
Harchesk says the robot was originally introduced in 2015 to help give people with disabilities virtual access to the museum's collection of contemporary art. But it's gotten more traction because of COVID.
This is pretty unique.
Yeah, it's still pretty unique. We're still the only ones in Europe. And I got like phone calls every week.
Ask me questions on how does it work? What do you need? What does a museum need to use it?
I find it's quite a funny story and also a half.
The Van Abbe Museum charges about $16 for an individual robot tour and about $50 for a group tour with a guide. But it's more of a public service than a moneymaker. And while Harches is glad she's been able to continue giving tours with the robot, she's hoping the day the museum reopens and live visitors will come very soon.
Katrina Adams has been a force both on the tennis court and in the boardroom. She was the youngest and first Black person to become CEO, chairman, and president of the United States Tennis Association. In her new book, Own the Arena, she details how her experiences helped prepare her for leadership. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker spoke with her about the book and being tested both on and off the court.
Is this a book about your playing career? Is this a book about your time as president of USTA?
It's a combination of everything. I like to say it's kind of like a This Is Us book. You know, I reflect on how the lessons I've learned through playing tennis, growing up in the sport, experiences that I had kind of relate to or prepared me for different moments that I talk about in the book. It's more of a leadership book. You know, there's 12 chapters, so I call them 12 winning match points or 12 takeaways, if you will, as to how you can take some of these stories and put them into your own life.
So how does your experience as a player, how does that translate to leadership?
Well, you know, I think I'm very fortunate as a tennis player in particular, as an individual sport. You know, you're out there alone, you have to figure things out. You're learning tactical skills, strategic skills, you're building your self-confidence, your self-esteem, being in pressure situations and having to make a decision as to what kind of shot I'm going to hit, et cetera. It's the same thing that we deal with in business. You know, I open up the book reflecting on the 2018 Women's US Open final with Osaka and Serena Williams and the moments after the match, being on the dais, where my words were misconstrued by many people.
These 2 weeks, you two have showed your power, your grace, and your will to win. Perhaps it's not the finish that we were looking for today, but Serena, you are a champion of all champions.
Just being in that spotlight in that moment, having to think on my toes and stay calm and poised in my delivery and in my intent. And so that was a situation where I feel that tennis, as well as my broadcasting experience, I was able to fire that up.
Yeah, I can imagine sitting there and kind of getting yourself into that headspace of like, okay, I've been down a point. It's a match point. This is a different kind of pressure, but maybe this isn't the same kind of pressure.
Oh, it was very different, but it's rewarding. Part of the 12 points is, you know, owning your table. You know, don't just have a seat at the table, own the table. And not so much as saying, okay, because you're the chairman of that board that you're owning it, but it's really owning your presence at that table, owning your knowledge, owning your input when you're at the table and not just kind of sitting back and being shy. You're invited to the table for a reason. Make sure you own that opportunity.
Was there a moment in your management and business career where you came to that revelation of ownership?
I've kind of ascended through an unorthodox way. I mean, I didn't go to business school. I didn't really go into corporate America. You know, tennis has been my life. And so all the experiences that I've learned have been through that. Obviously in tennis, you know, practice makes perfect. So you go out with different tactics, different strategies, et cetera. And you have that coach that you're relying on, that you're working with to get advice from. So I don't have a problem getting advice from anyone. You know, I know what I don't know. And I think that's the beauty of recognizing my weaknesses so that I can become stronger.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfein Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.